Horizon Christian Fellowship in Fitchburg, Massachusetts, Sunday, November 22, 2009.
Good morning. Hey, this week we pick up with 1 Samuel chapter 21, going verse by verse through the Bible, God willing, in 5 years. And maybe you've been reading the text in the Bible reading and the devotionals in the bulletin. But we pick up this week with 1 Samuel chapter 21, where we left off last week. I had a couple announcements for you. But on Thanksgiving, Ted Lapis heads up the Common Ground Coffee House. If you would like to help out as they serve the homeless, you're able to do that. Able to do that on Thanksgiving. Doors open at 12:30. Meal time is 1 p.m. on Thanksgiving. You can also bring homeless people in the area, and or you can serve. And we've got a cell phone number for Ted if you want to give him a call. And the prayer series tonight. Just want to apologize. Last week it was awful hot in the room we were in, and uncomfortable. So we've moved it up to the second floor this week, so I hope I didn't discourage anybody by having it in the wrong location last week. But 1 Samuel 21, I want to mention to you too, next Sunday night we start this week of fasting and prayer. We do it with other churches, and a really neat opportunity. Fasting, of course, is a private matter. That's something personally you do as you feel led. Nobody should know what anybody's doing with that. But there's a place for a body of believers to seek God corporately like that too. But we're joining with churches around the country, and we do the simulcast via the web. And this time, the emphasis is on revival. So every night, Sunday through Thursday night, 7 to 8:30 p.m., we'll be having the simulcast. So anyhow, 1 Samuel 21. David, remember from last week, he's a man on the run. He is a man that God has shot his arrow. And that arrow has struck David's life, and it has really redefined and changed his life. And so he's on the run. No longer at the palace, no longer hanging out with the king, no longer in that life of prestige. We're going to find them even in our text, hiding out in the cave, hiding out in the forest, running from people, embarrassing situations. We'll see him hungry in our text. We'll see him afraid. In fact, in chapter 21, verse 12, it says the very words, he was very afraid. This man, by God's doing, is on a journey, and it's a hard journey. It's a road of suffering and trial, but it's by God's design. As we study his life, we'll see where it takes him, and it's by God's purpose. But the interesting thing about studying 1 Samuel 21 and 22, and what is true of David's life a lot of times, is what we don't have necessarily. Maybe if you're reading through this, you didn't do this, but in the Psalms, there are Psalms that David writes at this particular time. Five Psalms he writes. He writes Psalm chapter 34, Psalm chapter 52, he also, it seems, writes Psalm 56, Psalm 57, Psalm 142. But during a life, a time of being on the run and suffering, he writes these Psalms. And what I like to do with you is you read the circumstances, you read the hard times, the confusion, the fear, yet you read what he writes during these times. And what you will find in the Psalms as we go through it is, even when he's hungry, even at times where he's, you know, had real awkward situations, or where he's even caused other people hurt, he returns to a key place, and the key place is that of trusting God. And he returns to the place of worship. You'll see it in his Psalms. And, you know, well, here you go. Psalm 56. David, very much afraid in his time in Gath, around that experience, he returns, he finds, he's able to get to that place of trusting God again and of worshiping the Lord. He writes this in Psalm 56, verses 3 and 4, at this very time. Whenever I am afraid, I will trust in you. In God, I will praise his word. In God, I have put my trust. I will not fear. What can flesh do to me? We read what we do, hard situation, and then we find what he writes. And he returns to that place of, when I'm afraid, I will trust in you. And then, very awkward experience he has in Gath. But then he says this in Psalm 34, verses 1 to 3. I will bless the Lord at all times. His praise shall continually be in my mouth. My soul shall make a boast in the Lord. The humble shall hear of it and be glad. Oh, magnify the Lord with me, and let us exalt his name together. And then while he's in the cave, in a moment, he'll be hiding in the cave. He writes this. Psalm 57, verse 7. My heart is steadfast, O God. My heart is steadfast. I will sing and give praise. Amazingly, this man, in all that he goes through, returns to the place of trusting God and returns to that place of worship. Now, I don't know about you, but that's really hard. When I'm afraid, it is really hard for me to trust when I'm afraid. When I'm afraid or suffering, it's really hard for me to praise. But David does that. I'm sure it's true, though, for you and I. I mean, that's the way you and I want to be. I mean, we can learn a lot from David and his example here. That's the way we want to be, trusting instead of being afraid, praising instead of fretting or complaining, and at peace instead of doubting, at peace instead of regretting. That's where David is, and boy, there's a lot we can learn here. And let's just ask God to speak to our hearts as we begin our study in this text together. Let's just pray for a moment. Dear Heavenly Father, we are thankful that we can open this book and seek your face together. Here we are, we gather in this place on Broad Street. We come from different places. And yet we need to hear your heart and your voice. And so we ask God that you would take away maybe the distractions that are maybe in our mind or in our heart or even around. And you'd settle us upon you, Lord, that we'd just be at your feet and hear from you. To be able to trust you is to have a life of peace. To be able to worship you as we even just sang the songs is to have that joy, and the joy of the Lord is our strength indeed. So we ask God, administer to us. Holy Spirit, be upon all of us, and even myself now as we go through your word. In Jesus' name, amen. Hey, let's read Psalm 21. 1 Samuel 21. 1 Samuel 21, verse 1. Now David came to Nob, to Ahimelech the priest, and Ahimelech was afraid when he met David and said to him, "Why are you alone and no one is with you?" So David said to Ahimelech the priest, "The king has ordered me on some business and said to me, 'Do not let anyone know anything about the business on which I send you or what I've commanded you. And I have directed my young men to such and such a place. Now therefore, what you have on hand, give me 5 loaves of bread in my hand or whatever can be found.'" The priest answered David and said, "There is no common bread on hand, but there is holy bread, if the young men have at least kept themselves from women." Then David answered the priest and said to him, "Truly, women have been kept from us about 3 days since I came out, and the vessels of the young men are holy, and their bread is in effect common, even though it was consecrated in the vessel this day." So the priest gave him holy bread, for there was no bread there but the showbread, which had been taken from before the Lord, in order to put hot bread in its place on the day when it was taken away. Now a certain man of the servant of Saul was there that day, detained from the Lord, and his name was Doeg, an Edomite, the chief herdsman who belonged to Saul. And David said to Ahimelech, "Is there not here on hand a spear or a sword? For I have brought neither my sword nor my weapons with me, because the king's business required haste." So the priest said, "The sword of Goliath the Philistine, whom you killed in the valley of Elah, there it is wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod. If you'll take that, take it, for there is no other except that one here." And David said, "Oh, there's none like it. Give it to me." Here we have David with a priest. This man on the run, he flees to this community of Nob, and there's the family of priests that are there. Many priests live here, and evidently, it seems the tabernacle at this time is in this community of Nob. He's alone, so to the priest, when he encounters the priest, he's a bit suspicious because he's alone. This man is a high-ranking official at this point, right? He works for the king. He's notorious. He's a man of prestige, and he's alone. And it makes him suspicious to the priest. But why has David come to the priest? Why has he come to Nob? Well, as you see there, he's come because he's hungry. David has physical needs, so he's come and he's seeking food at God's house and from the priest. And isn't that an interesting thing? Here we have God's anointed and hunger seeking bread. This is God's anointed. It would seem David, man, God's anointed, this giant slayer, he could readily get food for himself. You know, for him and his people, that wouldn't be much of an issue. But not at this point in his life. This man has come to God's house because he needs physical food. That's what we have here, isn't it? And that's interesting, I think, for you and I, if you consider, you know, you might be in a situation like that where you find yourself in a bread line, Maybe with the announcement I just made about the Common Ground Coffee House, you're thinking, dude, I'm going to go. I'm not going to help. I need a meal. That's why I'm going. And so you're maybe in a situation or have come to a situation where you're looking for help because you have physical need and maybe even hungry. But if you're in a situation like that and you're a child of God, it isn't that God has abandoned you. Sometimes we can think that. God's abandoned me. You know, God's forsaken me. But the question is, has God abandoned David here? God hasn't abandoned David, that's for sure. God is with David. But David is looking for food, man. David is in a hard place where he's asking for some help from even God's house. You know, you look at that, and it's a reminder to you and I that at times God does take his people down roads where there's physical need. God does allow seasons into our life where the brook runs empty, you know, the pot runs dry. The environment around us is barren, and God does it for certain reasons. Different reasons. Maybe it's to lead us in a different direction, like Elijah when the brook was dry. Or it's to test our faith to see how we will respond. Israel tested in that way, and yet they complained and murmured. Or like Abraham, Abram early on, where he, because of the pressure and the challenge of a famine, took some desperate action and really did some unwise things, took it into his own hands. Rather than trusting the Lord, what are we to do in these times? We're to trust the Lord. We're to seek him in prayer and to trust him. David finds himself hungry. He's God's anointed, and yet God is with him. Maybe that's a word for you today. You just don't feel like God's with you. Because, man, the pot is empty, the brook is dry, it is barren, and you're hungry, maybe. That doesn't mean God has left you. God may be using it in your life for certain reasons. I know in my life, I mean, those times come, God is teaching me to trust and to worship him, to come to that place. And I'm not very good at it, that's for sure. I give you stories. And, you know, so many, if you were up here, maybe you'd have your own story. But the classic story for me is early on when our refrigerator was completely empty and our cabinets, and we were without food early on in ministry. And boy, that is never easy when there's no food. No food. I mean, that, what do you do when there's no food? Well, eventually, after struggling, my wife and I got on our knees in the little office in our apartment. And right at that moment, as we prayed for God to give us faith, somebody knocked on the door, somebody I did not know who did not know me. Knocked on the door, gave me a box, left. And then I learned later how it worked out, but this box was filled with food. And this man, it turned out coincidentally, was traveling around the community giving out boxes of food from his church, little care packages, and had one left and decided as he was listening to WFGL AM 960, what am I going to do with this box, him and his wife? And they decided, hey, let's go find these radio people and we'll go give them the box. But as I share that story, there's many others. It happened right while we were praying, but we were out of food. I mean, we just watched it dwindle down to nothing. And on our knees, God, had God abandoned us? No. Had he forsaken us? No. I think earlier in the day we were thinking he had. But what we were learning is God wanted us to trust him. God wanted us to draw near to him. David's looking for some bread. Maybe you're in a place like that, and it doesn't mean that God's left you. Now, we see in this situation, you know, again, the Psalm 34. David writes Psalm 34 right after this experience. Psalm 34 and verse 9, he says this. O fear the Lord, you his saints. There is no want to those who fear him. The young lions lack and suffer hunger, but those who seek the Lord shall not lack anything good. You know, when did he write that? As you read through the Psalms, he wrote it at this period of his life. He wrote it when he was in Gath, next stop. Now, David is looking for some food. The God's anointed here is hungry on this road that God's taken him on. And the next thing we note is in the situation, with the pressures, he lies. He lies to the priest. He tells a lie. Now, why does he tell a lie? He does it because of the pressure. Things are not easy. The king is seeking his life. And for all those pressures in the moment when he's with the priest, he tells a lie. He says, hey, the king has sent us on business. And he sent me quickly, and da da da. But that's not true. He's running from the king for his life. The king wants to kill him. Now, as you look at this, and as you read on, if you've been reading with us in the Bible reading, David regrets his lie. Because what's going to come from this as you follow this through, though he does not intend, what comes from this is the very man that he's speaking to is going to get killed because of this situation. And everybody that lives in the community that he's in right now is going to get killed because of the situation. Because David doesn't speak the truth. David kind of makes it, explains it one way. Nobody knows what's really going on. And so they're not prepared for what's really happening. And it costs them their very lives. So David lies. He tells a lie, and it's something that he regrets. And the truth is, for you and I, it's never good to tell a lie. You can have that situation where the pressure is there, man, and you want to cook the books a little bit. You can have that situation where, man, I don't want to tell my spouse. You can have the situation, I don't know if I want to come clean with my parents or my employer, the IRS, whatever it is. But it's never good to tell a lie. You can just follow this through with David. It doesn't work out very well at all. In fact, it works out horrifically. Many challenges come with lying. I'll just quote to you. When Aristotle, who was a Grecian philosopher and the tutor of Alexander the Great, was asked what a man could gain by uttering falsehoods, what could he gain? He replied, "Not to be credited when he shall tell the truth." What do you gain when you tell a lie? One of the things you gain when you tell a lie is the next time you're with those people, they're less apt to believe you. We have this situation with our kids at times, you know. Growing up, when they've told a lie, next time around, you know, a situation comes up, you wonder if they're lying. And there's that frustration that they experience. I'm telling the truth. But when you don't tell the truth, when you lie, that's one of the things. David, after this experience, again, in Psalm 34, after this very experience, he stops at Gath, has an experience, and he writes these words. These are his words. Psalm 34, verse 12. "Who is the man who desires life and loves many days that he may see good? Keep your tongue from evil and your lips from speaking deceit. Depart from evil and do good. Seek peace and pursue it." David said, who's the man that desires a good way and a good life? That man, he says, if you desire it, speak the truth. Don't lie. Don't deceive. David does here, and it creates a real situation. Now, he gets bread from the priest, as you see there. The priest is this showbread. It's the holy bread. You may remember from your studies in the Old Testament, 12 loaves to put in the tabernacle or the temple. They're there before God. It's part of the worship of the Lord. 12 loaves represented the 12 tribes. They were removed. They're there for a day. They're removed. Fresh bread is replaced. Is put in there. And the bread that's removed, we read in Leviticus chapter 24, verse 9, that it is yet holy for the priest. In Leviticus 24, verse 9, "It shall be for Aaron and his sons, and they shall eat it in a holy place, for it is most holy to him from the offerings of the Lord made by fire by a perpetual statute." That bread was used in a sacred way, and though it's been removed, it's still yet for the priest. David's like, yeah, priest, you got any food, man? I'm in a rush and kind of hungry, my guys, too. And well, we got the showbread that we took out of the tabernacle from the place of worship there. And are you guys, have you been pure and set apart? Yeah, we've been pure, set apart. And David mentions, well, it's now that bread, if you have bread that's been taken away and the priests haven't had it yet, it's common. It's not in that sacred place in the tabernacle. Yet we read from Leviticus, it was still to be for the priest. Yet the priest gives it to David. And any mention in here of it being wrong that he had that bread? Any statement that it was a sin for him to take that bread? There's no statement, is there? But yet it was set apart wholly to the priest. Well, many of you have studied the Bible and you know this, but Jesus brings up this very story in Matthew chapter 12. In Matthew chapter 12, Jesus is with his disciples. And they're taking some of the grain as they go through the grain field for just food. They're hungry. It's the Sabbath. And the priests see that as breaking the commands of God. Well, what Jesus says to these legalistic, religious, ritual priests, he says, hold on, we're hungry, we need food, and that's wrong? He says, what about David back there in the Old Testament? David ate the showbread. David was no priest. Any mention of it being wrong? Obviously it wasn't. Because as Jesus explains, it's the spirit of the law and it's not the letter of the law. It's not just every letter legalistically interpreted. There's a greater standard, and the standard is, what does God mean by those words? What's the spirit of what he is saying? That's how we apply it. And so if you take the letter of the law every time, you're going to find yourself at times and places where you might misapply the word of God. Hang yourself with the truth that in that situation, God would have you apply it a little bit different if you understand the spirit of it. What did God intend? And Jesus said to the religious leaders, if you had known what this means, I desire mercy and not sacrifice. It isn't religious ritual and just going through the motions. It's about loving God and worshiping God and following God wholeheartedly. And so there's a place to show compassion indeed. When somebody needs bread, give him bread. Even this case, even the showbread removed from the tabernacle was fine because David was in need. It's about compassion, you know. Yet truth together, but compassion. David, while he's interacting with the priest, there's another man there. It's Doeg, and Doeg is the enemy. And as David is interacting and getting the bread and getting the sword, this man Doeg is watching what's going on. He notes it. Now this man, because of where he's at and what he sees, becomes a tool in the hands of the devil here in just a moment. This man, David describes him, evidently he's very wealthy because in the next chapter, David writes Psalm 52 because of this man. And this is what he says about him. Psalm 52, verse 1. Why do you boast in evil, O mighty man? And then in verse 7, he says, here is the man who did not make God his strength, but trusted in the abundance of his riches and strengthened himself in wickedness. This man evidently was wealthy. He's the chief herdsman. He's over the servants of Saul. But he's an Edomite. And evidently when Saul conquered the Edomites, maybe this man came into his service. But what happens here, it's important to remind yourself, is David is having a transaction with the priest, and he's not being honest. And he's thinking that it's not being known, and nobody's aware of what's going down. But that's not true. Doeg knows what happens. And Doeg, though, because of his position with Saul, interprets, I'm sure, can understand the gist of what's happening. And later he tells Saul. But there is a reminder to you and I that's consistent in the Bible that what you and I say and what you and I do, we're never alone. We might think we are on the phone, but what you say may not just be heard by that party, or it may eventually come out another way. Or what you do, what you thought wasn't really known, eventually sort of somehow makes its way out and is revealed. So therefore, the fear of the Lord, to always watch what I say, to always watch what I do. Because here's the way Solomon puts it in Ecclesiastes chapter 10, verse 20. Do not curse the king even in your thought. Do not curse the rich even in your bedroom. For a bird of the air may carry your voice, and a bird in flight may tell the matter. Solomon says, you're alone in your room, watch what you say. You may curse the king. And the way he describes it, a bird, have to be a parrot, I guess, flies over and just happens to regurgitate what you said to the king. Or you in your thought, and somehow it is made known. And that is a principle in the Word of God. I hope you're not thinking that what you've been doing, if you have, and I'm not accusing anybody, but if you're here and you're doing things in private and you're thinking it's not a problem, that nobody sees, that is not true. God sees, God knows, and he makes it clear, and eventually it comes out. You may be involved in conversations that you shouldn't be involved with, and the best thing to do is go make it right. Because what you say about others, it may very well get out. And that's the principle we learn here with David. He's thinking this lie is going to work out, but oh, does it ever work out to be a mess? Verse 10. Then David arose and fled that day from before Saul and went to Achish, the king of Gath. And the servants of Achish said to him, "Is this not David, the king of the land? Did they not sing of him to one another in dances, saying, 'Saul has slain his thousands and David his tens thousands'?" Now David took these words to heart and was very much afraid of Achish, the king of Gath. So he changed his behavior before them, pretended madness in their hands, scratched on the doors of the gate, and let his saliva fall down on his beard. Then Achish said to the servants, "Look, you see the man is insane. Why have you brought him to me? Have I need of madmen that you have brought this fellow to play the madman in my presence? Shall this fellow come into my house?" David's on the run. Notice in verse 10, even the words, "And David fled." Now in this particular case, it had been better for David to return than for David to run. And that is to return to this priest and go make it right. But he doesn't. He has an opportunity. Maybe if he did, the situation as we go could have unfolded out a little different. But David doesn't return. David continues to run. He is running from the king for his life. But in this particular case with this priest, he should have returned and made it right. And he doesn't. Well, we see with David, there's stops, there's processes, there's bumps, there's bruises, there's mistakes. Gosh, what a crazy situation here, isn't it? David goes from being with a priest, now David's with the enemy, the Philistines, the king of Gath. Achish, that's the Philistines. This is the enemy of God. And what happens when you got God's man with the enemy? You know, what happens when you've got a good man in bad company? What happens when you have a godly woman in bad company, the wrong company? What happens? Usually isn't very good what happens, is it? In fact, what often happens is when you got a man of God in the wrong company, is there's a real awkward situation. And what comes from a real awkward situation is an embarrassment, a compromise. God's man, God's woman acting in a way they never would normally have acted and doing things they normally wouldn't have done because they're hanging out in the wrong company. That's what happens. Isn't it strange? This is God's anointed. This is David, the giant slayer. He's got drool going down on his beard. He's scratching. He's acting like he's nutty. He's doing this before a fair amount of people. Why does he do it? He's caught in an awkward situation. Now Gath, you know, they sing the song. This man, David, isn't he the one they've been singing about? But you remember, Gath is where Goliath is from. Of course, you'd think in Gath, I know a little about David, because David killed Goliath, their big giant. David's there. David's on the run. David is afraid. While he's there, he even becomes very afraid. Verse 12, because now there's the word is out in the sense that why do we have this man with us is the way the word is out. Now, you don't get the sense here, but it seems that he's been taken captive because he writes Psalm 56. Psalm 56 says specifically at the very beginning when the Philistines captured him in Gath. And the only time it appears that David could have been captured in Gath was right here. So it's very possible when, you know, it says in verse 13, when he changed his behavior before them, and when it says in verse 14 where Achish says, "You brought this man to me," or when it says we're in their hands, those sort of statements, that man is in their hands, that maybe what's happened is some of the servants of the king have taken him captive and brought him before the king. So he's a captive at this point because they're afraid of him. I think that's possible. But because of the awkward situation, David is very afraid. Because he's very afraid, he really plays the part of a madman. He plays the part of a fool is what he does. I tell you what, that strikes out as an example to you and I too. I don't know about you, but you ever been there? Ever been there? And you ever found yourself acting strangely? Not like yourself, out of character, because of certain fears that come out as the real you is exposed before the world. Here you are, a Christian, in the wrong place, and now you're acting strangely because of an awkward situation. I think I could write a book on that from my experiences in college, where I was living a long time in the wrong crowd, and yet I was a Christian. I play the video of some of my college, and I like to go in and snip out part of that video Because there were some embarrassing moments where I just wasn't being myself. Because I'm a man of God hanging out in the wrong crowd. David is with the enemy. What does David do when he's with the enemy here? He acts like a fool, really, because of an awkward situation. If you're a young person here this morning, this afternoon, you know, wisdom says, man, hang out with the right crowd. You want to hang out with the wrong crowd and be cool, you'll find that you're not cool at all. In fact, you'll find yourself embarrassed. You'll find yourself doing awkward things because you're suddenly in a place you wish you weren't. Or somebody's putting something on the TV you wish they weren't putting on. Or they're bringing you into an environment you never knew you were going to be there. And now because you're a Christian, you're caught in this awkward place. And then you're acting strangely. Better to hang with the right crowd. Hey, be a witness to your non-believing friends, amen, and love them. But don't hang, man. Don't hang in the wrong crowd. If you're a young person, you'll save yourself a lot of heartache, a lot of embarrassment. Well, David, again, writes Psalm 34 while he's in Gath. Maybe as he's going out the town, I don't know, but he writes Psalm 34. That's what it says. And he writes this, verse 4 of Psalm 34. I sought the Lord and he heard me and delivered me from all my fears. They looked to him and were radiant and their faces were not ashamed. This poor man cried out and the Lord heard him and saved him out of all of his troubles. The angel of the Lord encamps all around those who fear him and delivers them. And then David says this. If you read through the Psalms, you're familiar with this. But note when David says it, it's right here in Gath. David says this. Oh, taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed is a man who trusts in him. You're like, the dude's got drool on his beard. That's when he writes that statement. Oh, taste and see that the Lord is good. Somewhere along the line here, David goes back to the place of trust. He's had an embarrassing situation. He goes back to the place of seeking God and trusting God and worshiping God. And he experiences a work of God at the same time. And so he says, taste and see that the Lord is good. Chapter 22 is in our Bible reading. Last one we'll look at. He says, David therefore departed from there and escaped to the cave of Adullam. So when his brothers and all his father's house heard it, they went down there to him. And everyone who was in distress, everyone who was in debt, and everyone who was discontented gathered to him. So he became captain over them, and there were about 400 men with him. But David went from there to Mizpah of Moab, and he said to the king of Moab, please let my father and mother come here with you till I know what God will do for me. So he brought them before the king of Moab, and they dwelt with him all the time that David was in the stronghold. Now the prophet Gad said to David, do not stay in the stronghold, depart and go to the land of Judah. So David departed and went into the forests of Herith. David's on the run. You see him with the priest. You see him now with the enemy, a minute ago with the enemy, and now he's in a cave. Dave in the cave, that's what we got here at the beginning. And Dave, you know, you just watch him. God has shot his arrow, and David is going down a lot of hard places, and he doesn't have a lot of choice with a lot of it that's going on. But David writes Psalm 56 again in this time, and he says this in verse 8. You number my wanderings. Put my tears in your bottle. And they, are they not in your book? He says, you number my wanderings. David's on the run, man. He's wandering. Nob, Gath, Cave of Adullam, Horeth, Keilah. David is wandering, man. Wanted to be in the palace. David's having a hard time. But he writes one day, at this period of time, exactly, he says, God, you number my wanderings. Point is, God, you know where I've been all along. You've appointed it. You're there. You take note of all the things. You know, Lord, you know it all. And you put my tears, my suffering, man, you know, you put my tears in your bottle. I remember one time being in a trial. And while I was in this trial, somebody who was out of state, a friend of mine sent me an email, heard about what was going on, and he just sent that one verse. You number my wanderings. Put my tears into your bottle. You might be in a place where, you know, you're at a cave or you're in an awkward situation, you're running here or going through things you just didn't know you'd be on the journey you are. Maybe there's even some tears. God numbers your days. He knows your days. He knows your tears too. You put my tears in your bottle? I wonder what that's like. I don't know about you, but I've never kept a tear in a bottle. I don't have any bottles of tears, though I've shed a few of them. But you can put my tears in your bottle. Every tear. Those tears are there because I'm hurting and I'm crying and there's pain. God says, I number them. If you're in that place, God knows. He knows. David's in the cave. He also writes Psalm 57 at this time, Psalm 142. This guy's in caves at other times too. In this season of his life, God's anointed. And he writes these psalms, and they're beautiful, beautiful things that he's learning along the way and being reminded of. And what we note, his family comes to him, but not only his family, those that are distressed, those that are in debt, those that are discontent gather to him. Man, I could be part of that crew. Distressed. Distressed with what's going on. Maybe about the king. In debt, having a hard time, disillusioned, and they gather to David. They are a motley crew, that's for sure. But as you know, as you start flipping the pages, it goes from this description to that they're mighty men. Some of these men become giant slayers themselves. Some of these men even slay lions themselves. But look where they start. Look where they start. They've come to David. They come to David in a hard time. And they're men going through hard things. And yet, because they're with David, God's man, look what God does with them later. You know, I look at that and I'm reminded of that whole mentoring principle, you know, that to have a godly mentor. What a blessing in a church. When there are men of God that are mentors to younger men of God. What a blessing in a church when there are women of God that have it in their heart to make the sacrifice to take young ladies, teenage ladies, whatever, and mentor them. I tell you what, when you have a godly mentor, you're often spared of a lot of evil. When you have somebody who you respect and you can receive from, invest in you, and tell you a lot of good wisdom, it usually spares some people of a lot of hurt. To have mentors, man. To have godly mentors in a church. Men and women. David is a mentor to them. He's the giant slayer. In fact, he's killed lions and bears too. They come to him in debt and a mess. Later you read about them killing giants. And killing lions. I tell you what, it's not easy. But to invest your time, to be a mentor, it's a sacrifice. But wow, you know, Gordon MacDonald used to pastor Grace Chapel. Maybe you've been there. I guess he's now in his 60s, late 60s even maybe. I don't know his age exactly. I was at a place where he was sharing recently. He's retired. I mean, what a great church out there in Lexington that he pastored, and God's used him in a lot of ways, but he's not doing that anymore. But you know what he does today in his late 60s or whatever his age is? Him and his wife, at the beginning of every year, they go to about 20 people, 20 young people specifically. They find 20 young Christians, knowing that a few won't be able to do it because they look for 15. And they go, they say, listen, make a commitment. We'll give you 32 Monday nights next year. 32 Monday nights. We will be completely faithful if you'll be faithful, and we'll mentor you. We'll spend time with you. Gordon MacDonald's been doing that. 15 young people, 32 Monday nights. And you know what he's seeing? In fact, he exhorted a group of pastors I was with. He said, man, if we all did that, we would change New England because of the fruit that's come from it in the last number of years that he's been doing it. Interestingly, too, the things the young people learn from him, they learn a lot of different things from him and his wife, but what they've noted more than anything when they're done after 32 Monday nights, if they learn more than anything, is like, you know what's really blessed us the most? It's just watching you, Gordon, with your wife and watching her with her husband being with a godly couple for 32 Monday nights. It's changed our lives. Mentoring, man, sometimes it's just being with people, sharing what you think you know, and it may be a lot, but just because you love Jesus, the way you can affect the next generation is amazing. And the next generation needs mentors. It's men of God, and women of God will take the time and spend time with them, invest in them. Be faithful to do it. Who knows what God could yet do? Dave in the Cave, Motley Crue. Boy, they come out as mighty men in God later. You know, this Motley Crue, this is the way he describes them. Psalm 142, written while he's in the cave. Verse 7, he says this. Bring my soul out of prison, that I may praise your name. The righteous shall surround me, for you shall deal bountifully with me. The righteous, he's got a Motley Crue, but seeking God and yet the righteous to surround him. You know, many will see a picture in this with David. David is a type of Christ, meaning in many ways, his experience, we can look and consider Jesus. And David is the anointed, but there's a man, Saul, who's no longer anointed, who's on the throne. And the world in Israel is going around and around based on Saul's leading and government. But David is God's man. And these men go with him, and he's in a cave. And it ain't easy to hang out in a cave and suffer. There are times they're this close to death as they hang out with David. But that's like Jesus. Right now, there's somebody else on the throne of this world, right? Jesus is on his throne. He's sovereign. But there is one who's leading, in many ways, is influencing the world. You can tell when you turn on the TV. You can tell when you listen to the radio. There's the devil. There's Satan, the prince of the power of the air. And he's influencing so much that goes on. And the world is just following that tune. But then, for you and I, we become discontent with it, disillusioned by it, realize our debt because of all our bumps and bruises, our spiritual debt and our sin. And we go to him who's Christ, who suffered. And we go with him. And we, in a sense, we suffer with him in this world. But these men will later be rewarded. In fact, when David becomes king, some of these men will have high places, a lot of influence, because they stood with David and they served David. It's true also with Christ. Right now, I follow Jesus, and it's not the most popular crowd. In fact, it can be a hard crowd to be in. But the day is coming, he'll take note when he rules and reigns in his kingdom, his messianic kingdom, and he'll reward. So there is a picture of Christ. David places his parents into the protection of the king of Moab there in those end verses that we read. Now, David's grandma, great-grandma, was Ruth. She was a Moabitess. And we would presume, especially, he's protecting his family from Saul. Well, all these things, David's on the run. He's in the cave. He's been with the enemy. He then ends up in the forest. He's on the run. And while in a cave, you know, a cave, stone, dirt. A cave, I don't know about you, but I don't want to live in a cave. But what does David say in this very time? Psalm 57, he writes it while he's in the cave. Be merciful to me, O God. Be merciful to me, for my soul trusts in you. And in the shadow of your wings, I will make my refuge. He goes to that place of trust and worship. And though he's got stone walls around him, he yet understands, I'm in the shadow of your wing. There's no better place to be than that. Hey, now to the end of the chapter, as we have just a few minutes here. When Saul heard that David and the men who were with him had been discovered. Now Saul was staying in Gibeah under a tamarisk tree in Ramah, and a spear, with a spear in his hand and all his servants standing about him. Then Saul said to his servant who stood about him, hear now, you Benjamites, will the son of Jesse give every one of you fields and vineyards and make you all captains of thousands and captains of hundreds? All of you have conspired against me, and there's no one who reveals to me that my son has made a covenant with the son of Jesse. And there's not one of you who is sorry for me or reveals to me that my son has stirred up my servant against me to lie in wait, as it is this day. Then answered Doeg, the Edomite, who was set over the servants of Saul, and said, I saw the son of Jesse going to Nob, to Ahimelech, the son of Ahiatah. And he inquired of the Lord for him, gave him provisions, and gave him the sword of Goliath, the Philistine. So the king sent to call Ahimelech the priest, the son of Ahiatah, and all his father's house, the priests who were not, and they all came to the king. And Saul said, hear now, son of Ahiatah, he answered. Here I am, my lord. Then Saul said to him, why have you conspired against me, you and the son of Jesse, in that you've given him bread and a sword, and have inquired of God for him, that he should rise against me to lie in wait as it is this day? So Ahimelech answered the king and said, who among all your servants is as faithful as David? who is the king's son-in-law, who goes at your bidding and is honorable in your house? Did I then begin to inquire of God for him? Far be it me, let not the king impute anything to his servant or to any in the house of my father. For your servant knew nothing of all of this, little or much. And the king said, you shall surely die, Elimelech, you and all your father's house. And the king said to the guards who stood about him, turn and kill the priests of the Lord. That's never a good thing to say. Because their hand also is with David, and because they knew when he fled and did not tell it to me, but the servants of the king would not lift their hand to strike the priests of the Lord. And the king said to Doeg, you turn and kill the priest. So Doeg the Edomite turned and struck the priest and killed on that day 85 men who wore a linen ephod. Also Nob, the city of the priest, he struck with the edge of the sword, both men and women, children and nursing infants, oxen and donkeys and sheep with the edge of the sword. And one of the sons of Amalek, the son of Ahiatub, named Abiathar, escaped and fled after David. And Abiathar told David that Saul had killed the Lord's priest. So David said to Abiathar, I knew that day when Doeg the Edomite was there, they would surely tell Saul, I've caused the death of all the persons of your father's house. Stay with me, do not fear, for he who seeks my life seeks your life, but with me you shall be safe. David's now in the forest hiding. We got this madman. While he's in the forest, there's a madman who's going insane, and it is actually the king of Israel who's going total insanity and paranoia. David is his friend with this man because David is on the run for his life from this man. This man, in his own paranoid thoughts, discerns that he must be hiding to get him. Well, when he confronts his people because he's heard that his son and David have a special relationship, he confronts his people, sort of plays the violin. No, come on, you know, why hasn't anybody told me of this? Nobody answers, but Doeg was in the tabernacle that one day. And Doeg speaks up and says, I saw David. I saw him with the priest, and the priest gave him Goliath's sword and gave him food. Now, David, in Psalm 52, he writes that at this time, he describes Doeg this way. Your tongue devises destruction, like a sharp razor working deceitfully. You love evil more than good, lying rather than speaking righteousness. You love all devouring words, you deceitful tongue. God shall likewise destroy you forever. He shall take you away and pluck you out of your dwelling place and uproot you from the land of the living. Well, horrifically, one of those chapters in the Bible I just like to get past because it's horrific. Saul, who's God's man at one time, who's got so far off track, never to return, really, actually gives the order to an Edomite to kill the priest. And that man doesn't just kill, you know, Ahimelech. Ahimelech, he goes through and kills 85 priests, kills babies, kills wives, completely destroys the entire community. In a strange way, Saul was supposed to destroy the Amalekites this way and can't even do that. But when it comes to his own people and the priest, he comes with such huge vengeance. Well, the only survivor is Abiathar, the only priest that makes it. And he comes to David, and when David hears it, David says, I knew, man, I knew better. I knew that guy heard. I didn't do anything about it. I didn't tell the truth. The entire town is dead, and 85 priests. David learns, you know, his earlier fears and the pressures caused him to lie, and that unbelief has led in such a mess. It's just a reminder, it's a warning to you and I to get to that place of trusting the Lord and standing and being courageous and not giving in to the pressures. You know, what do you do, David, after you just discovered you could have spared a lot of lives? What do you do, David, after you just heard that 85 men, their wives, little babies have been killed because you weren't shooting straight, because you were afraid? What do, David? You know, the interesting thing about David is David comes back to the Lord. He writes in Psalm 52, verse 8, he says this, "But I'm like a green olive tree in the house of God. I trust in the mercy of God forever and ever." David goes back to the mercy of God. What do you do? What do you do when you've discovered and you didn't even intend that you've caused pain in other people's lives? What do you do when you get a report like that? My wife and I, maybe you've seen the movie. We were watching the movie, The Last Sin Eater. I don't know if you've seen it. It's a good flick, man. And in this movie, The Sin Eater, it's a story of a girl. And she lives in the mountains, and there's these pagan rituals. And it goes back to hideous things that had happened earlier before her time. But they have a ritual, and it's the sin eater that is a way to deal with the sin of people because there's so much guilt in this community, but it doesn't really deal with it. It's a very pagan way. This girl in the movie is ridden with guilt. She believes, not intending to do, but she's cost the life of her sister. You see it play out in the movie. But throughout the movie, she is trying to find a way, because a lot of people are suffering, her mom included, because her little sister has died and she believes she's responsible. She's trying to somehow get past it. So she, this careful sin eater who lives in the mountains, she seeks him out, and you're told not to go there. She wants somehow some sort of deliverance. Gets with the sin eater, and he's got this weird mystical ritual, and he's a very scary looking dude. She goes through this ritual, and you watch it happen in a movie. And she's laying there, and he does his thing. And as soon as she's done, she goes, "I don't feel any different. I don't," but it's really a despair. "I don't feel any different." I mean, she's been seeking this guy forever, trying to find. "I've caused so many people pain." And yet she didn't intend to. Well, as if you've seen the movie, Michael Landon produces the movie, but as the movie goes on, she comes in contact with a gospel preacher who then, hearing about her guilt and her struggle, says, "You know, there is a true, the great sin eater. And let me tell you a story about Jesus." And when she hears about him and his mercy and his forgiveness, on the spot, she finds healing and deliverance. And you see it in the movie. Freedom. What do you and I do? Had an awkward and embarrassing situation. What do you and I do? We've caused hurt of other people. What do you and I do? Well, we even find out, you know, I didn't mean to do that. Here's what I've done. What do you and I do? What does David do in all these situations? David comes, makes his way somehow, somewhere, back to trusting God, back to his confidence in the compassion of God, confidence in the mercy of God, the love of God, and the grace of God, and he worships God. That means you and I can do that here today, no matter where we are, what we've been through, what we're going through. Let's stand together.
Horizon Christian Fellowship in Fitchburg, Massachusetts can be contacted online at horizonfitchburg.org or by calling 978-665-9111. Our service times are 8:45 and 11 a.m. on Sundays and 7 p.m. on Wednesdays.